Ministries, and my collaborators in this project are my former business advisor, Chuck Serra, Max Pacini, a couple of grad students at Caltech, Don Erb, Matt Hunt, and Naveen Reddy, and then Kurt Adelberger, who's at Carnegie Observatory. Okay, so the sample of galaxies we're going to be talking about are galaxies in the redshift range 1.5 to 2.5, which is known as the redshift desert. And the redshift desert attained its name due to the difficulty in spectroscopically confirming galaxies in this important epoch of the universe. The reason for this is that at redshifts lower than redshift 1.4, star-forming galaxies are confirmed by measuring the wavelengths of light emission lines from H2 regions, like forbidden lines of oxygen and hydrogen recombination lines. But at redshifts greater than 1.4, the bluest of those lines, the oxygen 2 line at 3727 angstroms, is out of the optical range, like past 9,000 angstroms, and so it becomes difficult to confirm galaxies in that range from emission lines to break. Aging galaxies also shift out of the optical range. Okay, then at redshifts below redshift 2.5, though, Lyman Alpha and a lot of the strong UV rest frame absorption lines that are used to confirm, let's say, minor bright galaxies at redshift 3, not shifted into the observed optical frame. So again, it's difficult to spectroscopically confirm galaxies. But I guess I'd like to show you about a different way to confirm galaxies. And this touches on a little bit like what Scott was talking about. If you use a combination of optical selection techniques and UV optimized spectroscopy, it turns out that it's pretty easy to assemble a quite large sample of these redshift desert galaxies. So on the left here, I show a color plot. This is in the U minus G, G minus R color space, so a U filter at 3800 angstroms, a G filter at 4800 angstroms, and an R filter at about 6900 angstroms. And up here, the green and yellow region indicates the part of color space in which redshift 3 galaxies are found. And what these tracks show are the direction in which star-forming galaxies travel as they increase in redshift. So, and also the blue and turquoise and red show increasing amounts of dust extinction. And so this is the region in color space used to find redshift 3 Leonard bright galaxies. And this magenta region is what our group used to photometrically pre-select redshift 2 galaxies. And so what happens if you then follow up these galaxies using the, as Scott mentioned, the very sensitive UV spectra, the ELRIS blue arm spectrographic, the Keck telescope, what you can see here in blue and red are our resulting redshift distributions. And so we have a blue histogram, which was sort of targeted to find galaxies at redshift 2 to 2.5, and a red histogram used to find galaxies at redshift 1.5 to 2. And so what we find is 860 galaxies at redshift greater than 1, 692 of which are in this redshift desert range of 1.4 to 2.5. And this is the redshift 3 histogram sort of appropriately normalized. Okay, so there's a whole lot of things that we can do with these galaxies. I'm not going to talk about most of them. I'm just going to zoom in on the rest frame optical. But if you look at here are some bright examples of spectral ranging. This is just an increasing redshift, the lower redshift half of our sample. What you can see is, so we're in the rest frame UV here. They have strong low ionization lines, interstellar lines, and high ionization lines, which we think are tracing outflowing gas. They have wind features from Wolf-Rayet and O stars. We also see nebular carbon 3 emission from H2 regions. What we see, at least observationally in the sample, that there's a lower frequency of Lyman alpha emission as compared to the registry Lyman bright galaxy sample. But we haven't exactly figured out how much of this might be due to selection effects, but at least that's something preliminary. And the other thing is that in cases where we measure both Lyman alpha emission and these low ionization interstellar absorption lines, we see the same kind of evidence for large-scale outflows as we do in the redshift 3 sample. So, so this is just to summarize our observations. We've conducted our redshift 2 survey in 7 fields, 5 of which are quasar fields with bright background quasars, so that we can study the same relationship between the distribution of galaxies and the intergalactic medium that we did at redshift 3. And we also have a couple of fields like the Goods Field North and the Gross Westphal Field, which have a lot of multi-wavelength data. So far, we've selected the galaxies for optical imaging and follow-up check spectroscopy. We've also done some near-infrared imaging at 2 microns in the K-band, and we'll get some other near-infrared data at 1.2 microns. And what I'm going to focus on at the end of the talk is just this retron optical spectroscopy, which turned out to be pretty exciting. And then, of course, for the Goods Field and the Gross Strip, there's a lot of multi-wavelength data at X-ray, radio, and far infrared wavelengths. And so the survey has pretty ambitious goals. Of course, we want to look at things like the clustering of these galaxies and their UV luminosity function, and also, as I mentioned, look at the relationship of these galaxies to their IGM environments. But I guess what I'd like to talk about today is a little bit what we're learning about the galaxy properties themselves. And so, okay, that's just a comparison with other redshift desert surveys. I think we've assembled a quite large survey of galaxies to compared to other surveys in this redshift range, about an order of magnitude larger than anything else. So this is the results of our near-infrared imaging. We've conducted this K-band imaging in a few of our survey fields. This is the K-band apparent magnitude distribution for 200 or so galaxies. And I think the one point I want to make with that figure is that if you look here, only 10% of our sample is brighter than K of 20. There's been a lot of sort of theoretical comparisons between the K20 survey of Chimani et al. And Semyonov. But I guess the point to take away here is that by selecting things in the near-infrared brighter than K of 20, you're only really getting the tip of the iceberg of star-forming galaxies at redshift 2. I guess the other thing to mention here is if you look at their optical to infrared colors here and compare them with what we see at redshift 3, just to preface this, if you have the same intrinsic spectral energy distribution at redshift 3 and redshift 2, it'll give you the same R minus K color, so there's no K correction. So what we see here is that at redshift 3, the mean R minus K color is 2.85, whereas at redshift 2, it's like 3.23. So we see about half a magnitude redder in R minus K at redshift 2, and this could be due to a number of effects, either aging or more dust extinction or maybe H alpha in the K band. And so we're definitely going to follow this up. One thing that seems that's clearly important is what I show here is the spectral energy distribution of a 300 million year old constantly star-forming galaxy. And at redshift 2, you can see here's where our optical photometry probes in the rest frame UV, and then J, H, and K in the rest frame optical. So the J band at redshift 2 to 2.5 probes this bomber break area, which should tell us a lot about what the shape of the SED is and should tell us stuff about aging. Okay, so the thing that I'm really excited about and that I wanted to focus a bit on is near-infrared spectroscopy, so spectroscopy probing the rest frame optical. And so redshift 2 is really ideal for looking at several different nebular emission lines because we see oxygen 2 in the J band, oxygen 3 in H beta in the H band, and then H alpha nitrogen 2 and sulfur 2 in the K band. Initially, we just did this near-infrared spectroscopy to just measure the systemic redshifts of the galaxies to make an accurate comparison of the galaxies in specific places in the Lyman Alpha Forest. But it turned out that this area was like rich in many other ways. So if we start out looking at H-alpha kinematics, again, I said we were just trying to get redshifts of galaxies, so we were just trying to get as many galaxies as possible by positioning our slits in multiplex. But it turned out that even still, we found these tilted H-alpha emission lines. So to interpret, to understand what the slide is showing, in this direction we have the spatial dimension. These little bars indicate 1 arc second, and this is the wavelength dimension. So we see these tilted H-alpha emission lines. If you just sort of look at the velocity of H alpha, the redshift of H alpha as a function of position, what you see are these, you know, rotation curve-like things. Now, I should mention, of course, I know this is been brought up whenever someone shows this plot, is that these points are not independent. We only have like a few independent points across these rotation curves. But I think you would agree that the tilt and shear in the line is undeniable. If you just interpret these curves as rotation curves and take half the velocity difference at the radius at which we measure this velocity difference, the minimum implied dynamical masses are about 4 times 10 to the 10 solar masses. Of course, these things don't look like rotation local normal rotation curves in that we don't see any flattening even out at like 10 kiloparsecs. Also, you know, these things are much less steep than local rotation curves, which would sort of look like this, but at least some of this must be due to the effects of seeing, which we can already tell can significantly sort of make these curves shallower than they are and make us underestimate the rotational velocities. We've had some sort of perplexing experiences following up galaxies in the good north field where we actually could position our slit intelligently and did not find any higher instances of rotation, in fact maybe even less less frequent. So this is all work that's been led by Dawn Erb, and she's so we definitely need to do some kind of near infrared integral field spectroscopy. Okay, great. Okay, now, so I guess while we do find a more frequent instance of rotation at redshift 2 than redshift 3 Lyman Break galaxies, you know, and this we might, I guess, in my most optimistic state, I might try to convince you that we're seeing the growth of disk galaxies. You might say, oh, well, I don't believe that. Okay, fine. But if you do something that's much less sort of model dependent, maybe, if you just compare the distribution of velocity dispersions in the redshift 3 and redshift 2 samples, what you can see is that at redshift 3, this is the distribution of oxygen 3 velocity dispersions, which is about 76 kilometers per second on average. However, at redshift 2, we see an average of 115 kilometers per second. So definitely it looks like there's a higher average velocity dispersion in our redshift 2 sample. I should mention we're using H-alpha at redshift 2 and oxygen 3 at redshift 3, but I think in cases where it's been compared for galaxies where you have both, there's not a systematic difference.
Do you have a velocity dispersion within the galaxy?
Yeah. This is mindless.
Instrumental redshift in these cases?
Oh, in some cases, in most cases it's resolved by, I mean, the instrumental resolution, It's often about 2/3 that, I think. So the instrumental version is like 15 angstroms. We often measure full with half max of like between 20 and 30 angstroms. Okay, so the last thing I want to mention is what we know about the metallicities of these galaxies. Okay, so the real way to measure H2 region abundances is to measure electron temperatures and do the real abundance analysis. But this relies on measuring weak auroral lines like oxygen 3, 43, 63, which is really hard to see in local galaxies that aren't extremely metal poor, and we have no chance of seeing it in redshift 3. So there are many ways to sort of cheat and use empirically calibrated strong line ratios, like the ratio of oxygen 3 plus oxygen 2 over H beta, or in this case, it seems that the nitrogen 2 to H alpha ratio in local star forming galaxies correlates quite strongly with the oxygen abundance. So this is work by Dennis Kolo et al. So here we have this ratio of nitrogen 2 to H alpha versus oxygen abundance. There's some caveats about this using this line ratio to versus metallicity, but to the zeroth order or whatever, it should give us some rough idea. And so what we did was after assembling a large sample of these H-alpha redshifts, we decided to cheat a little, make our lives easier, and look at galaxies which we knew from our near-infrared imaging were going to be bright in the near-infrared, that 10% of the K less than 20 galaxies. What we find when we actually target galaxies that are bright in this rest frame optical is that more than 50% of them have this nitrogen 2 over H-alpha ratio, which indicates supersolar metallicity. And this is at redshift. I don't know if you can see the redshift. This redshift is 2.4, 2.4, 2.15, 2.1. So we're seeing supersolar metallicity in these redshift 2 star-forming galaxies. I mean, we also see, for example, we see sulfur 2 emission lines. So these things appear to be pretty metal-rich. I don't think they're AGN because we have UV spectra which show no evidence of AGN. But they already have yielded a lot of metals and are still forming stars at quite rapid rates. Now, okay, maybe you don't trust that metal indicator, but we have about three other different ways of measuring the metallicities in these galaxies from their rest frame UV spectra. Here, if you zoom in here, this is a wind feature from OSTAR, the P Cygni carbon 4 wind feature. It's seen both locally and high redshift. The profile of that wind line correlates with metallicity, so we can use that to try to test the metallicities of these galaxies. Also, there are lots of blends of photospheric lines from hot stars in this region of the spectrum. These are also empirically calibrated to change with metallicity. We can measure these things as well in our spectra. And finally, if we're getting deep UV spectra, so we can try to look at unsaturated interstellar lines from outflows in these galaxies. And in this case, we can also try to measure a hydrogen column density. We can look at the abundance and abundance pattern of the outflowing material in these galaxies. So we have many different ways of of measuring the metallicities. And I guess, so this is these different metallicity indicators, okay, I think they're important for trying to study the evolution of chemical enrichment in galaxies, but also, since we know from looking at the redshifts of Lyman Alpha as compared to these outflow lines, that these galaxies are sustaining these large-scale outflows, it's important for trying to understand the evolution of the enrichment of the IGM. Especially these things are pretty metal rich. So I guess in summary, I hope I've shown you that we've assembled a large sample of spectroscopically confirmed galaxies in the Redshift Desert, which I would argue doesn't really exist anymore. We have a wealth of information about these galaxies, both in the rest frame UV and rest frame optical. We've seen from H-alpha spectroscopy evidence for rotating disks. And also at the luminous end of the sample, we see evidence for supersolar metallicity, which is pretty important for understanding both the enrichment of these galaxies and also of their surrounding environments. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Yeah.
So we can construct the distribution of offsets between Lyman Alpha and the interstellar lines. And I'd say the average offset is it's about like 450 kilometers per second or 500 kilometers per second versus like 600 in the Lyman Bright galaxies. We also for the I think we've also looked at, for the ones where we have the H-alpha nebular systemic redshifts, we see the same thing where the UV line, the interstellar absorption lines are blue shifted by about 150, 200 kilometers per second, and Lyman Alpha is systematically redshifted, but by like different amounts. So looks like it's pretty similar to redshift 3. Rachel? Oh, I should be sorry.
Two questions. I thought it was interesting that after hearing Chuck's ideology of at least 10 talks where he would say, oh, the integrated alignments of the redshift 3 LBG tell mean anything, the gas is just sitting down and it's changed well, it means nothing about the dynamics, but now you're showing this as evidence that you're seeing that still at redshift 3 redshift 2. Do you not believe that argument?
I think one difference is, you know, if you look back at the I think one difference is that there's like no dynamic range in the redshift 3 zone, right? Like all the line lengths were like the same and they didn't correlate with anything. Whereas at least in the redshift 2 sample, we can try to look for it does seem like, you know, we see ones with bigger line lengths and ones with smaller line lengths, and that like, I think we haven't looked in detail at like, how exactly they correlate with like luminosity or something. And I think the thing is, I think once we started seeing the tilted lines also, that it seemed like, you know, maybe they did look to be like ordered motions, sort of, whereas in the redshift 3 sample, I don't know, we didn't really see any evidence of that.
So what I'm asking is, do you interpret this as just saying that the redshift 2 sample is different, or do you interpret it as meaning that they're dynamically more masculine?
Yeah, right. I think we haven't thought about it carefully enough. I think that all I can say is that, you know, we've gotten different, we see different, we don't see exactly the same things on the two samples. You know, I guess the first order thing is, you know, saying, well, maybe there is some kind of, but I think we haven't really done a really good job in trying to relate them to each other. I mean, one clear thing to try to look at would be, you know, how does the clustering of these galaxies compare with the clustering of the redshift 3 galaxies? We've sort of done that preliminarily also, but it looks like they have about the same clustering strength. I guess I don't really have a good answer. I think we haven't exactly quantified how they relate to each other. I think though, just when we started seeing the tilted lines, so it just seemed like maybe we felt more comfortable trying to relate that to dynamics.
Do you think this Z2 and put a Z3 and see what you think you'd see? I mean, you just see for example all the central regions and then all your signals are being slower.
Well, I think, I mean, they have pretty similar sizes, right? I mean,
if you look at affecting the image as they seem to split a redshift 3 and see what observed.
I agree. I think that would be a good thing to try. I mean, really haven't.
That explains that shift of the
image. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's a good thing to try. I mean, these things are pretty compact. I mean, we're not seeing some kind of... I mean, we haven't really looked at...
Right. If you actually put it much further away, they might not produce a result, or, you know, surface brightness image, they might actually maybe concentrate on just one part and give you a shift of histogramal to another velocities.
Yeah, I think that would be a good thing to try. Yeah.
At redshift 3, you don't see a child plan anymore. So it would be comparing apples to oranges.
Well, the clear thing to do is look at these redshift 2 galaxies in oxygen 3, and that's what we're going to do in the spring, so.
One more question.
You mentioned several different indicators for mechanisms, the nebula lines and stellar lines. Do these agree relatively well with each other?
Yeah, so for the one case that we do have all of these things, there's one that's like really, it's a really bright galaxy at redshift 1.4. We've looked at its P-Cygni profile, and it seems to indicate solar metallicity with a standard Salpeter IMF. And then we look at this not totally breathtaking photospheric blend of lines, which also seems to indicate solar metallicity. There's another blend that's not shown on the slide at 1978 angstroms from B-star iron lines, but also indicates solar metallicity. So, this galaxy is at redshift 1.4, so we don't see Lyman alpha. We don't have any H1 lines with which to measure a hydrogen column density. There's been work by the Gemini Deep Deep Survey where they measure the abundance pattern by assuming a hydrogen column density, but you know, I don't really think that's a valid thing to do. So we don't have an estimate of the abundance and the outflow. No. But we will, because we clearly measure Lyman alpha, Lyman beta, and other Lyman lines in the UV because the spectrograph is really sensitive. So this is something that we're definitely going to pursue, is look at the abundance and the outflowing material.
We've got to move on.
Okay, sorry.